Good afternoon and welcome to the White House. I'm Corey Shulman in the Office of New Media, and October is Cybersecurity Awareness Month. And continuing this annual celebration, we're very pleased to have a special Open for Questions event with Howard Schmidt, who is the Coordinator of Cybersecurity and Assistant to the President at the White House. Thanks everyone for joining us, and thank you for being here. Right now, I'm keeping an eye on a live Facebook chat. If you're not in the chat and you have a question on cybersecurity awareness, go to whitehouse.gov/live where I'll be scanning your questions. We've also been collecting your questions over the past couple of days on Facebook and with about.com. So we've got a whole host of great questions on cybersecurity awareness. And before we jump into your questions, I'm going to turn it over to Howard for a quick introduction.
Well, thanks, Corey, and thanks for the opportunity to be here today. This is a great venue, and I love doing the live online pieces. As you mentioned, as the President's Cybersecurity Coordinator, we've got a pretty interesting job from looking at everything from security around end users and consumers all the way up to and including what we do with between governments and how we come to agreements and things of that nature. But it's an interesting time because technology has been a part of everything that we do. We call it critical infrastructure protection in a lot of cases, but it talks about the communication systems, the entertainment systems, the transportation systems, the energy systems. All of these things are run by technology today, and we're very fortunate to have that technology available to us. But even with that, there are forces out there, good bad guys and bad actors, as we call them, that look to do everything to commit crimes like identity theft, credit card fraud, shutting down systems for all kinds of reasons. And our job in the President's direction is to make sure that we minimize the likelihood that any of these things will have a long-term effect, or even for the most cases, how we can help people do that shared responsibility of protecting themselves. Cybersecurity Awareness Month, this is the seventh year we've been doing this. It's probably the biggest and baddest seventh anniversary celebration we've had for Cybersecurity Awareness Month yet. We're doing this all over the country. We've got international partners helping us. So it's great to be here and be talking about cybersecurity and how we can better protect ourselves.
Thanks. So with that, we will jump right into questions. If you're just joining us, go to whitehouse.gov/live. There's a link to join the Facebook discussion, and I'll be scanning your questions and taking them in live. We're going to start with a question that comes from an about.com reader. His name is Dan from Springdale, Utah. And his question is, some countries work hard to make sure that only approved information is available to their own citizens on the web. Does the Obama administration regard the wide open and freewheeling character of the internet as a national security asset or liability?
Well, Dan, thanks for that question, because when we look at what we use the internet for, as I mentioned in my comment a moment ago, everything from communications to entertainment, but the administration looks at it as a vehicle by which that we can communicate freely internationally. So when we start looking at things about content and discussions of things that I think we all hold very dear to us from a democracy standpoint, we believe that it is a national asset to be able to do that, which is consistent with the way our government has been built and the way we all live our online world. And the thing is that we need to work collaboratively internationally to make sure we protect those freedoms online, make sure that we're doing the things we need to do to give us the ability to do that while protecting the technology at the same time.
Okay, so this is a question that's just come in live from Facebook. It comes from Zach Carmichael, who asks, what is the greatest single cybersecurity issue or threat that you, Mr. Schmidt, use today?
You know, that's a really good question, Zach, because when we start looking about the things that people ask me all the time is what keeps you up at night? And I think the biggest thing is when we designed the internet as we know it today, we built the applications, we built the routers, we built the Wi-Fi network. We didn't fully realize in many cases that bad things were going to happen like they have today. So we didn't pay a lot of attention to reducing the vulnerabilities. And that's sort of the biggest thing today is how do we wind up reducing the vulnerabilities to make sure we're better protected. And there's some ways to do that. And of course, National Cybersecurity Awareness Month gives us a lot of those tools. When we start looking at keeping our systems up to date and patched, making sure our antivirus and malware software is up to date on a regular basis, making sure that we're using strong authentication, such as strong passwords for critical sites. These are all the things that sort of keep us up at night. But more importantly, these are things that we can do something about. And you, as a matter of fact, can help do it by doing some of these things. StaySafeOnline.org is one of the websites that gives us a lot of good information on how to protect ourselves online and go a long way to reducing these vulnerabilities that we deal with.
Here's another question that comes from Facebook. Adam Helsinger asks, the administration has showed strong tendency to embrace innovation through the fundraising methods used during the presidential campaign, moving whitehouse.gov to an open source platform, embracing citizens by using social media, etc. Are there plans to leverage the hearts and minds of Americans with crowdsourcing strategies to protect us from cybercrime?
That's a really good question when you start looking at the capabilities we have as an internet community or net citizens, as we refer to ourselves as. The same things that give us the ability to communicate in social networks about things that we enjoy doing, we have to apply to protection of cybercrime as well. One of the things is using some of the technologies we're doing today and talking about some of the things that people can do to help protect themselves. But we also have some really good resources put together. And a good example is the FBI, in concert with the National White Collar Crime Center, a number of years ago pulled together the Cybercrime Center, which is actually a website where citizens go to and provide information about potential vulnerabilities, things where people become victim, information about those committing cybercrimes. And it's a good way to get all these things together in a central location and help push those out, particularly in the United States, state and local law enforcement, so they can help leverage the things we're doing in our own cities. The other thing is be done is through local block watch programs and things where actually citizens get together that understand technology, use the technology, and share with each other how they can come together and in their shared responsibility help each other better protect their systems so they're less likely to become a victim of cybercrime.
If you're just joining us and you want to join the discussion, go to whitehouse.gov/live. There's a link and you can hop right into the live Facebook chat where Howard will be answering many of your questions. I have another question that comes from, this one comes from about.com. And this is a person in Virginia, or actually her name is Virginia. She's from North Carolina. She wants to know what guidelines are currently in place pertaining to White House, Pentagon, or other governmental employees, down to and including employees at local levels, regarding their taking PCs out of the office, i.e. home, traveling, et cetera. How are lapses in this protocol presently handled?
Well, as I mentioned a few moments ago, we as a government are looking to leverage all the aspects of technology, including the ability to do remote access. Things where people, particularly in bad weather conditions, where you'd have to work from home and things. So, part of that goes with the policies this agency has, depending upon its region, to make sure that we have the ability to provide the services as a government from any location, whether it's in the office or outside the office. With that, we also have policies very strictly that say things that contain information about citizens, or what we refer to as PII, personally identifiable information, that we're doing all we can to protect it. For example, there may be policies indeed in agencies that says you will not take information that from work to a home or to a trip or someplace like that unless it's protected by encryption. We look at removable media such as USB sticks, DVD, anything that we could move data from a work location to another location, those things need to be protected as well. So it's a real balance. We need to make sure we're protecting the data, but still giving the ability to deliver those services. And we have good policies in place, but we are just as important as having the policies in place to protect it, we also have a good process in place to deal with incidents where, say, something gets stolen out of someone's house or car, to be able to report that and immediately notify those affected by it so they can better protect their information as well.
Thank you. Here's another question from Facebook. It comes from Kathleen Reed, and she wants to know, on Facebook, there have been several games released that glean personal identification information that can be used for identity theft. As far as I know, the perpetrators have never been pursued or apprehended as criminals. What's the plan for protecting us from these cyber criminals, and what's the plan for teaching all of our children to protect their personal information?
You know, and that's a great question, because when you start looking at some of the capabilities we have, and as an avid Facebook user and longtime Facebook user, I always worry about some of the applications. As I said in the very beginning, those that are out there are looking to somehow have a negative impact on our ability to use the technology are ones that the government, particularly the law enforcement community, looks to send a clear message that while you may get away with it once in a while, we will look for ways to identify, collect the evidence, and prosecute you for these things that you're doing. So while a lot of these cases may not be public, there's oftentimes a mechanism by either state and local law enforcement or federal authorities investigate these things and hold these people accountable and prosecute them for it. Internationally, it's even more of a challenge. Because while we look to some of the criminal activity that goes on online, it's not uniform around the world. So we need to make sure we're working with our international partners to ensure that if they're working from a country outside the United States, that number one, the laws exist to give those countries the ability to investigate and prosecute those people, but also that we're cooperating to make sure that the evidence we may collect here in the United States through one of these pieces of bad apps that we see out there from time to time, that they're able to use that to prosecute them in their country as well. We don't catch them all as much as we'd like to, but we do have a process in place to investigate these things and successfully prosecute people.
Thanks. I have another question that comes from about.com. Felicia wants to know, how concerned is the White House that the web is serving as an environment for international cybercrime? How are you going to address the problem with regard to the U.S. infrastructure?
Well, I think there's two pieces of this. Ever since man has been around, there's been criminals that do all kinds of things. You start looking at burglaries and auto theft and those things. While we work really hard to contain them, we've never been able to stop them, just like we can't stop criminals from doing things. But what we can do is, as I mentioned a moment ago, look for ways to make sure we minimize the ability for them to create victims. Number one, a number of years back, the U.S. government ratified a treaty called the Council of Europe Cybercrime Convention, which went a long way to making sure that we have harmonization of cybercrime laws. We have a 24/7 hotline back and forth between the various countries. So our law enforcement agencies, no matter where they are in the world, can identify criminal activity, contact someone in another country, and do the things that we need to do to protect against that. But like any other piece of criminal activity, there's a lot of things that we need to do to make sure that we're reducing the likelihood that someone becomes a victim. What we generally refer to as crime prevention. And that's where things like Cybersecurity Awareness Month really help us in teaching people how to better protect themselves online. Once again, Stay Safe Online and OnlineOnGuard.gov are two very good websites that help us put us in a better position, the less likely become victims of cybercrime.
Thanks. If you're just joining us, go to whitehouse.gov/live, where there's a link to join the discussion on Facebook. We're getting a lot of great questions. One question from Facebook, this comes from someone named Harad Minasian, and they want to know, is there a cybersecurity emergency plan in place so that in case of an emergency, cyber terrorists do not attack our critical technology infrastructure?
And thanks for that question, Harad, because when we start looking at the fact that if there continues to be people committing criminal acts out there and doing things to affect our infrastructure, one of the key things that the government has needed to do is put together an incident response plan. This is what we call the National Cyber Incident Response Plan, or the NSERP. Just even a few weeks ago, we had this international exercise called Cyberstorm 3 that brought in resources from, I think, we were more than 11 countries, more than 2,000 people worldwide, 31 private sector agencies, as well as the broad group of government agencies to come and exercise this incident response plan, which not only gives us the ability to identify what we've got going, but it's a great learning experience because as technology changes, as we become more dependent upon, say, the peer-to-peer technologies and the ability to communicate in a real-time basis, by bringing this incident response plan together, it doesn't make any difference what the person's motivation is, whether they come from anywhere in the world, that we have a plan in place, that we bring all of government together, we bring all private sector together, we bring all of international partners together to make sure that the impact is minimal, it's the shortest duration, and we have the ability to recover in the quickest time period possible.
Thanks. I have another question that comes from about.com. William would like to know, with newly passed legislation requiring expanded reporting of income payments via Form 1099 in 2011 and 2012, is the administration going to implement any safeguards to protect taxpayers' personal information, i.e. names, address, social security number? Shouldn't the government be taking steps now in advance to protect its citizens?
And that's a very good question. We have just recently with the Office of Management and Budget here at the White House and the White House CIO, a great technologist, a great friend, Vivek Kundra, revamped some of the things of what we call FISMA, the Federal Information Security Management Act. Obviously, we're not going to have any shortage of acronyms and things that we'll be using during this cast. But FISMA, one of the things that we looked at FISMA was, what are the things that we can do to better protect the personal information of our citizens? And so with FSMA, some of the changes we've made, for example, is we're doing continuous monitoring. So if we identify a problem with an IT system, it's not a matter of coming back months later and correcting it. We can identify it in real time or near real time basis and fix it right away. It also puts the agencies in a position where they have a higher level of responsibility for data protection. As I think we all recognize, when we start looking at why do people attempt to intrude into systems, whether it's government or private sector, it's all about the data. And so as we do more through FSMA, we do more through dedicated efforts on behalf of the people that run our IT systems in the government, with a specific focus on proactively protecting that data before it winds up in a position where a system is intruded upon and then we have to go back and recover. So we have a lot of good plans in place. We don't look at these as a one-time shot. We constantly adjust as technology. We constantly look for new ways to better protect that information as well.
Okay, if you're just joining us, go to whitehouse.gov/live so you can hop into the Facebook conversation. I have a question that just came in from Julia Sink, and she wants to know, if you're a victim of cybercrime, how do you go about reporting it, and whom would you contact in reference to this issue?
And that's a really good question once again. When you start looking at the likelihood of us becoming a victim, while it's very small, it still happens. So one of the first things you would want to do is reach out to your local law enforcement agency, whether it's a police department or a sheriff's department. Virtually the vast majority of law enforcement agencies within the United States now have some sort of a dedicated cybercrime unit. People that are specifically trained in forensic analysis of computer systems, investigating online crimes, as well as things relative to credit card theft and identity theft that we see all the time. That would be the first step. The other options I mentioned, going to the National White Collar Crime, the Cybercrime Center, and doing a report through there. Because what that does is it gives you the ability to get a better picture across the law enforcement community, who's doing the crimes out there, and in many cases, to focus some of the efforts. The other thing, indeed, if you've become a victim, particularly relative to credit card fraud or identity theft, contact your credit bureau and your financial institutions immediately. Because what happens is, while the law enforcement investigation may be key to helping identify and hold these people accountable for their criminal acts, there's also the other piece. We need to work with the credit bureaus, the financial institutions, to make sure that we let them know this has happened, so they can put, you know, credit stops on some of our credit cards, that we can do things on the credit bureaus to make sure that people aren't opening accounts in our names. And those are things that can really help minimize the impact of somebody that's been a victim of cybercrime.
Okay. I've got another question from Facebook. This comes from Greg Russo, and he wants to know, what steps will the federal government take to facilitate the hiring of new cybersecurity and privacy professionals?
You know, Greg, that's wonderful, because that's one of the things we've been talking about for a long time, is how do we get more technology specialists, particularly in the area of cybersecurity, into the workforce across the government? Well, we have this initiative called the National Initiative for Cybersecurity Education, which, in addition to Cybersecurity Awareness Month, we look at workforce development inside the private sector, the university courses that are available, the high school courses available, to really generate the next generation of technology specialists that focus on cybersecurity. We look at the federal government. We actually have career paths we're working on now, so you can come in as, say, an apprentice-level type cybersecurity trainee and work your way up to be a leader and actually run IT systems from a security perspective. The best place to find information on that is usajobs.gov. It's a website set up. You search for cybersecurity, security, technology, and you'll get an opportunity to see what's available across the entire government spectrum.
We've got another question that's coming in live from the Facebook chat. Darren Bethia says, or asks, I work with seniors and many have aversion to the internet. Are we doing anything to especially inform seniors?
And the benefit that seniors can get from technology are just unbelievable, particularly when they relate to talking with kids and grandkids and all those sort of things. And as I've worked with some of the senior groups around the country, we try to allay them of those fears. Technology is not that difficult, particularly some of the advances we've made recently, but they also have to be concerned about being targeted from cyber criminals. So when you start looking at some of the seminars we've done with the local law enforcement crime prevention units, look at some of the things, once again, we're doing with Online On Guard through the FTC, and actually reaching out to those specific groups so they can really benefit from the technology while also understanding there's risk out there and how to minimize the potential for them becoming a victim.
Thanks. Here's another question that comes from about.com. Christy in Massachusetts would like to know, so many doctors' offices and hospitals are now using portable devices in making patient records available online. What's being done to protect the privacy of our health records, and is there any way we can recover from the inevitable leaks of personal information?
And Christy, that's a really good point, because one of the president's key initiatives is the health IT initiative, to be able to create electronic records for us to benefit no matter where we are in the country, to have the maximum benefit from the technology in the health industry. We actually have a program that's been run out of the HHS organization looking at how do we create this environment of health IT records, but on the front end of these things, look to make sure we're protecting privacy and security and building out this architecture. We're very fortunate to have my offices leading that effort on the cybersecurity piece for the e-health records and e-health initiative, working with our experts across the government and the private sector to make sure we have that mechanism in place to make sure that people don't wind up in a position where they become a victim. Once again, it's the idea is to proactively prevent this from taking place. So looking at all the medical devices that are out there that have great information, the portable devices we use, the ability to, in small and rural communities, to benefit from the technology as part of the architecture we're building very proactively to build security and privacy protection into the system.
Okay, here's a question that is also coming from the Facebook chat, and a lot of people have actually been asking about it. Zach Carmichael wants to know, with the rise of popularity in mobile phone use to access the internet, is there a U.S. federal government emphasis on protection of mobile devices and security education?
And that's one of the things as we become more dependent on mobile devices, that the same sort of risk that we've seen over the years going from servers to desktops to laptops, we worry about those for the mobile devices as well. So when we start looking at some of the apps that we're putting on there, some of the fact that now we have the ability to do mobile banking, mobile booking of reservations and airlines and hotels, we have to have the same basic principles apply on the mobile devices that we've had in recent past in desktops as well as laptops. So things such as secure it by using a PIN number. So if somebody, if you lose it, which happens a lot, if you lose it, people don't get access to your information. Make sure that when you're using mobile device to log into financial services or to do things where you wind up having a credit card available to somebody, to make sure you're using a strong password or strong authentication mechanism into using that mobile device, even more so than you would with a desktop environment. The other thing we're doing, we're working on what we call the National Strategy for Trusted Identities in Cyberspace, or the NSTIC, and looking to make sure that we have the technologies that work to protect identities online to make sure they're applicable for mobile devices as well.
We have another question that's coming in from the Facebook chat, and this comes from Matthew Parks. He wants to know, what are some of the major points that you would like to tell us about regarding a federal tech plan that would streamline workflow and improve the U.S. infrastructure?
And when we start looking at the U.S. plan for that, as I mentioned earlier, Vivek Kundra, the CIO for the U.S. government, and our other close colleague, Anish Chopra, the CTO for the U.S. government, as we lay out the tech plan moving forward, looking to leverage in an e-gov environment that's more transparent, that's more open, that gives more access to the citizens, we fully recognize in deploying that we have to build the security and privacy protection in the front end. So we have a requirement at any government agency that's rolling out a new plan to be consistent with our tech plan, that they have to have a security plan in part of that and make sure it's approved in advance, leveraging the concept that we want to create it once and use it many times over and over.
If you're just joining us, go to whitehouse.gov/live. There is a very active discussion happening on Facebook. I have another question for you, and this comes from Josh Schroeder. He wants to know, what is your view on torrenting in P2P? Should ISPs be able to shut it down, or do you have plans to upgrade backbones to provide for legal traffic at high speeds?
You know, when we start looking at the benefits we get from peer-to-peer technologies or torrent technologies or any of the things that we do for file transfers, we always have to be very cognizant of the intellectual property rights that we as end users enjoy. A lot of effort has gone into creating content, whether it's software, whether it's music, whether it's video. So as a consequence, using this technology, we need to make sure we're doing it in conformity with the law and the protections that we have for the property. So while the technology itself is great, misuse of the technology is probably the thing that we need to be very cautious of.
Okay, I've got another question. This comes in from Sammy Atik, and they would like to know, can transparency build better workspaces, or will it create toxic business areas?
I think transparency will build a better work environment for us. And I think back to the president's commitment earlier this year about transparency. For example, in the cybersecurity environment, there was a document created called the Comprehensive National Cybersecurity Initiative, or the CNCI, that the president directed declassifying that document, talking about how we're going to do a better job about protecting the technology we deploy within the U.S. government and the private sector. So in this case, when we start looking at the benefits we get from any workflow environment from technology, openness is better. We have the ability to get various viewpoints on what are the weaknesses we have, but more importantly, how to fix those weaknesses as well.
Okay, here's a question that comes from Suchi Pati, and she wants to know, is the U.S. government planning to give free and daily up-to-date antivirus and firewall software in the future to help keep everyone secure, or is this an unreachable dream?
Well, I don't know that it's a role for the U.S. government, but I know many of the ISPs out there, many of the financial institutions provide that service free to customers to begin with. That's one of the big things when we're, once again, looking back at Cybersecurity Awareness Month. As the month started, I got a number of emails from major providers out there that saying, yes, we are now providing free antivirus and even bigger anti-malware software to our customers free of charge. So that's one of the things I think, I don't know that's a direct role for the government, we encourage it, but I think a lot of the companies are doing it already out there that help us do a better job about protecting ourselves.
Okay, well, we are actually about out of time. Thank you everyone for joining us, all of the participants in the dialogue on Facebook, those that submitted questions on about.com. Thank you, Howard.
Thank you.
If you are looking for more information on cybersecurity, visit whitehouse.gov. We have links to the places that Howard mentioned during the chat. And thanks for joining us.
Thank you.